Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. You know, the story of Detroit's automobile industry would be incomplete unless we talk about the two Henrys. One, Henry Ford, everyone has heard about, but very few people have heard about Henry Leland. And that's what the first item is about today. The Ford-Leland duo in the development of Detroit's automobile industry. Those two men have helped transform Michigan into the automotive center of the world. In part, this is due to the complex relationship that they had with each other. And together, they did more than create an industry. They shaped the political and the cultural landscape of the state and of the world around Michigan. Let's look back to 1890. Detroit and Michigan at that time were waking up to the industrial age. Detroit was becoming a hub of rail and water transportation. Industry was beginning to prosper with the production of rail cars, and stoves, and bicycles, and more. Henry Martin Leland arrived in Detroit that year. He came from the East, which was the center of manufacturing in the country at the time. Leland's training and skills in precision machining were formidable, to say the least. Seeking an opportunity to start his own business, he partnered with Robert Faulkner to establish the company Leland and Faulkner. That firm was soon the premier machine shop in the Midwest. They produced parts for industrial machines, bicycles, and the expanding gasoline marine engine industry. Leland and his company pioneered manufacturing methods for gears also, making them stronger, quieter, and cheaper. Henry Leland was a man who could feel a thousandth of an inch, and he always carried a micrometer around in his pocket to prove it. Around 1890, Leland also became aware of the work of Carl Edvard Johansson in Sweden, whose steel U-blocks were made with a tolerance of 1 to 100,000 inch. So Leland got one of the first sets in the United States and used it to create even more accurate machines, allowing him to keep tolerances on parts that he made to within 1/10,000th of an inch. The significance of that accuracy cannot be overstated, since precision manufacturing allowed for the true interchangeability of parts. Complex machines such as automobiles, which began to appear the following decade, could be assembled without the careful fitting, filing, or hammering that took much time and skill, meaning that it was possible for relatively unskilled workers to assemble machines. When automaking became a big industry in Michigan, huge numbers of unskilled workers eventually led to the formation of industrial unions, including the United Auto Workers. Many factors helped create the unions, but the army of well-paid, unskilled workers in the automobile and related industries likely would never have existed without Leland's invaluable contributions to precision manufacturing. Henry Leland's work in precision manufacturing helped draw several early pioneers to Detroit and to propel their careers. Ransom Olds, enticed by the machine shop resources of Detroit, moved to the city to be closer to his supply chain for parts for his Oldsmobiles. Leland and Falconer made many parts for the early Oldsmobiles. For example, Leland redesigned the transmission for the curved dash of the Olds, eliminating one of the car's weak points. He also designed an improved engine for the Oldsmobile. That careful machining and superior design allowed for more than twice the power. However, Olds was not swayed to switch to Leland's design, in part due to the production delays and the added cost that implementing the new engine would have caused. Also, David Buick, Henry Joy, Benjamin Briscoe, Barney Everett, and William Flounders, all of whom lived and worked in Detroit, studied and copied Leland's manufacturing methods. Horace Dodge apprenticed with Leland before starting a machine shop with his brother, John, in 1901. And, as an aside, my aunt was the nanny for Horace Dodge's children in Grosse Pointe, and also the nanny for Henry Ford II's children. So, in a way, the Dillmans are involved in the automobile industry's history. One of the companies for which Leland supplied parts was the Henry Ford Company, Ford's second try in the auto business. And by early 1902, the business, only a year old, was floundering. Investor William Murphy brought in Leland as a consultant for the struggling firm. But Ford resented working for Leland, and in March 1902, he left the company with a $900 settlement and plans to make a racing car. While most of the investors favored liquidating the enterprise and settling for what they could get for their assets, Leland stood up. He pointed to the company's prototype chassis and his new one-cylinder engine, the one that Olds had rejected. "Between these two, we have the potential for a car," he said. That company needed a new name, and while many wanted to designate it as and the new car in honor of Leland, he insisted that it be named after Antoine de la Mothe Cadillac, the founder of Detroit almost 200 years before. Thus, Leland was hired to run the newly established Cadillac Automobile Company. Meanwhile, Ford started his Ford Motor Company. The industrialists applied to the Association of Licensed Automobile Manufacturers, ALAM, for a license. The ALAM controlled the Selden patent on the automobile, and it exacted license fees and royalties from every car that was manufactured. Leland was the chair of the association's admissions committee. And this committee turned down Henry Ford's application, saying that he was, quote, not a reputable manufacturer, unquote. Ford was already chafing from the circumstances surrounding his departures from the Henry Ford Company. He was convinced that Leland had blackballed him. And as a result, Henry Ford defied the decision of ALAM and was soon one of the largest automakers, going on to fight the organization in court. He eventually won, but by that time, the Selden patent was ready to expire. And one of the results of the litigation was the cross-licensing agreement in the Detroit industry, meaning that after a year, any car maker had the right to use something patented by another auto manufacturer. That greatly sped up technological development for the Detroit car makers. It gave them an advantage over manufacturers in other parts of the country. Both Henrys were to prosper in Detroit. Leland's Cadillac was exceptionally well made for the price, and it had healthy sales. His Leland and Falconer manufacturing company was also absorbed into the renamed Cadillac Motor Car Company. And in 1908, Cadillac won the Dewar Trophy, which was awarded each year by the Royal Automobile Club in Britain, with a stunning display of interchangeable parts. The following year, the company was purchased by Billy Durant, forming one of the cornerstones of General Motors. Durant insisted that Leland continue to run Cadillac. In 1912, Cadillac won the Dewar Trophy again with the new self-starter. Leland did not invent the electric starter, but he had the vision to make Charles Kettering's device and make it standard on a production car. With that advancement, everyone could drive, not just those who had strong arms and a robust physique. Well, Ford took manufacturing lessons learned from Leland and used them to build one of the greatest production systems in the world. Where Leland used Joe Blocks, Ford enticed Carl Edvard Johansson to move to Dearborn and to apply his skills in Ford Motor Company's tooling department. Ford believed precision parts were so important that he banned files and hammers from the plants. If a part didn't fit, he immediately took the car apart, he looked for the root cause, and he corrected it. And by 1920, Ford Motor Company had long been the largest car maker in the world, selling Model Ts everywhere. In 1919, James Cousins, who was an original shareholder at Ford Motor Company, he had left after an acrimonious dispute with Ford, which I might add was not uncommon in those days, and he became mayor of Detroit. His signature issue was the public ownership of the city's streetcar lines. There were several hard-fought referendums, and Henry Ford allied with other leading Detroit businessmen to support the streetcars continuing under private ownership. But the key referendum came in 1920. As usual, Ford sided with Detroit's business leadership. But then, Henry Leland joined the group and became one of its leaders and spokesmen. That apparently was just too much for Henry Ford. While Ford was still smarting from Cousins' departure from Ford Motor Company, he disliked Leland even more. He switched sides, funding the campaign for public ownership now. And Ford's support, both publicly and financially, carried the day, and the mass transit system of Detroit became a public operation, a practice that was replicated by other cities across the country. All the while, things had not been going well for Leland at Cadillac once Durant took charge. In 1917, Henry Leland left his beloved Cadillac. At the age of 74, when most men would have retired a decade earlier, Leland and his son Wilfred started a new company to build Liberty aircraft engines under license. Airplane engines were in very short supply at the time, but Henry and Wilfred had the resources and the skills to mass produce these complex machines. Investors, once again, wanted to name the new venture after Leland, but he refused once more. Instead, he named the company after the first president he had voted for, and the president he considered to be the greatest president of all, Abraham Lincoln. World War I ended just a year after the company was formed, and the government canceled all of its contracts for engines. Saddled with a huge manufacturing investment, Henry and Wilfred Leland decided to do what they knew how to do best: make luxury cars. Their new car, the Lincoln, was launched in 1920 into the edge of an oncoming severe depression. What remained of the luxury car market at that time was dominated by Packard and Pierce Arrow and Peerless. But Lincoln was to survive, and is today still a luxury car. And there you have at least the beginning of a story of the two Henrys. Now for the most interesting segue you've heard in a long time, because we're going from automobiles in the early years to wolves, and how wolves help drivers. Fairy tales have given wolves a bad rap, but new research in Wisconsin suggests that the animals may have inadvertently saved dozens of human lives by killing deer. Just under 20,000 Wisconsinites crash into deer every year, resulting in about 500 injuries and 8 deaths. But that toll would likely be higher without wolves. Why? Because they tend to prowl along the roads and trails, attacking and scaring away the deer. And after analyzing 22 years of data, researchers have concluded that wolves have cut the frequency of deer vehicle collisions in Wisconsin by at least a quarter. The state's wolf population started to grow in the 1990s, and that rise correlated with a fall in both deer numbers and deer-related road accidents. Accidents involving other animals didn't decline. The Atlantic magazine further suggesting the deer-eating wolves are responsible. Wolves do this work all year long and at their own expense, according to an ecologist at Western University in Canada. She was not involved in the study, but she says it certainly seems like a win-win situation. And I would end with this comment that maybe we could use a few more wolves in Michigan, where I go to a summer place once in a while, and at dusk and after dark, you have to be very careful driving along the highway there. And now, we're going up into the sky, away from the roads of Wisconsin, where we're talking about wolves and deer, and we're going to talk about UFOs. In a recent article in The Atlantic, it says, if you're hoping to get proof that aliens are visiting our planet, you're likely to be disappointed. This month, a Pentagon task force is required by law to reveal that information it's gathered about numerous unidentified aerial phenomena that have been detected by U.S. military aircraft. Exactly what their report is. In one sense, the objects seen by pilots and captured on radar and film are real and merit further study, but there's no reason to think they're alien. Why not? Well, the space between stars in our galaxy is unfathomably vast, and unless extraterrestrials can violate the laws of physics, it would take dozens of years or centuries to reach the Earth. Why would they do that? Only to zip around in the clouds, playing peekaboo with military pilots. More boring explanations are far more likely. Visual phenomena, camera glitches, meteors, or surveillance drones, perhaps from other nations. This might be the answer. If we do find terrestrial life, it's far more likely to be in the form of microbes or primitive organisms below the icy surface of moons of Jupiter and Saturn, or in signals detected by astronomers who are scrutinizing other solar systems and planets. Is ET already here? Playing hide-and-seek in the skies? Probably not. And now, it's been a while since we've had a little bit of wit and wisdom. In other words, quotations by famous people. John Steinbeck once said, ideas are like rabbits. You get a couple and learn how to handle them, and pretty soon you have a dozen. F. Scott Fitzgerald once said, "At 18, our convictions are hills from which we look. At 45, they are caves in which we hide." Jeffrey Maiden says, "The dust of exploded beliefs make a fine sunset." And finally, Lewis Mumford, the historian, said, "Every generation revolts against its fathers and makes friends with its grandfathers." And now, my friend, we're getting toward the end of today's program. I want to encourage you to tune in next time. Ask you to be safe out there. You have a good day, and you tune in to 101.5 and listen to a little of this, a little of that. I'll be waiting for you. So please come visit, stay a while. And now Willie Nelson and I are going to go down the road looking for some more items for a little of this, a little of that.